I noticed Mrs. Prickett's wearing a beautiful scarf, and she got her son-in-law talked into wearing a matching shirt. As you got ready for church today, who was running late? Most of us come as couples or families. Maybe we come with a friend and you might have had to wait on somebody. But who was running late? Who were you waiting on as they put on their tie or brushed their hair, accessorized? After you figured out who was running late, did you make some remark about their continual tardy behavior? I heard on the occasion of counseling that one fellow was having problems with his wife and hadn't heard the sermonette today yet, and they were disagreeing about things, and he knew something was wrong. He could feel the coldness in the air, and it just wasn't right. So he asked her, "Well, what's wrong?" And she looked at him and said, "You don't know?" He says, "No." He says, "Well, I'm not going to tell you." Confrontation. In Luke 17:1, it says there's always going to be offenses. Now, we try to move past that. And as you get older, you realize some things you can just let slide. You know, they're just not worth it's just not worth hooting about. When you're young, everything's important. When I got married, I didn't like chicken. I still don't like chicken. But I get chicken. And it doesn't make any difference what I say. I'm going to get chicken. So I just shut up, Zimmerman. We keep the fast of atonement. The first fast I kept with joy, and we were going to start the day, you know, with a meal before the sunset, chicken. I was so right, I would not eat that dinner. And I suffered more and more. I confronted her about it, but some things just aren't important after a while. In Romans chapter 12, a book given to more to doctrine than some of the others, a couple of verses. Romans 12:18. If it be possible, as much as lies in you, live peaceably with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. It's written, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay," says the Lord. We do need to resolve differences, and as I've read to you from Luke 17:1, there's always going to be something in the air that's going to cause us to maybe lose a little attention where we should be otherwise placing it. And we should rather esteem to live in peace. And give wrath its own home somewhere else. There's always something trying to come into your life to cause that ill breeze blowing. But on the other hand, there are difficulties that arise and we must confront them. And we need to understand this thing called confrontation. I want to look at confrontation with you today using some biblical models. Confrontation, as a word goes, is it's a dirty word. You say there's confrontation happening. You think of someone yelling at each other, and perhaps in our society today it's become more like that. But if you look at the word etymologically, take it apart. And you remember your prefixes, suffixes, the root in the middle, you'll find that con means together or with, and fron, F-R-O-N, the middle of the word, the root, means face to face. And simply what it means is two people working together face to face to resolve some issue. And I think it's better that you look at confrontation that way, etymologically. It's simply a matter of two people coming together face to face to resolve an issue. And as I said, there are some ways to look at the subject, and I want to look at it through three different views today: biblical examples, behavior models, and some keys to effective confrontation. The Bible is filled with examples of confrontation, people coming face to face to resolve issues. And I've just taken the opportunity to start very early in the Bible and to look at this. I was amazed after studying this for a couple of months just how germane it is to God's Word that we work out differences face to face. We also realize that we're in the image of God, and our opportunities to change our behavior to that godly image is renewed every time we find ourselves in confrontation. The first case I want to bring to your attention, you're well aware of, Adam and Eve in Genesis 3, the first 13 verses. Genesis 3. It says in verse 1 that the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made, and said to the woman, "Has God said that you shall not eat of every tree of the gardens?" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die." Don't steal the fruit from the tree. And the serpent said to the woman, "You will not really die, for God does know that the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you shall be as God, knowing good and evil." Well, she saw that good, tempting fruit. It was pleasant to the eyes. She desired it. She knew it could make her wise, so she took. And did eat, and gave to her husband with her, and he did eat. And all of a sudden, their eyes are both opened. They knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. And they heard the voice of the Lord walking in the garden in the cool of the day in the afternoon, and Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God amongst the trees of the garden. So they heard him walking through the leaves and twigs and realized that there was a visitor. And so he called to them and said, "Where are you?" And Adam replied, "Well, I heard your voice in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." And so the Lord God says, "Who told you you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree that I commanded you that you shouldn't eat?" And the man said to the woman, "The woman gave it to me to eat. She gave me the tree. Of that fruit I did eat." And the Lord God said unto the woman, "What is this that you've done?" And she then said, "Well, the serpent beguiled me, and I did eat." So we find this time-honored story. They hear the footsteps, and that got their attention. And in an adventure that they were having to get to know God and God getting to know his creation, he asked, "What have you done?" And when they were confronted with that, they played the blame game. "He made me do it," or "She made me do it." And so the theft that they had been involved with and the disobedience, they never were willing at that point to take clear ownership of and say, "Yes, I did it, and this is why I did it," or "I was wrong," or "Tell me why I was wrong." When you look at the context of this, we see the Creator knew that what they had done, but he went ahead and asked them anyhow. just like your child, when you find your youngsters at home doing something and you find that the behavior needs to be altered, what are you doing? And you know what they're doing. Why are you doing that? And you know why they're doing it. But God's that way to us. We are His children. And so the focus, well, we have a culture that tells us this is a hard God that we're reminded of in this Old Testament. Wash that thought from your mind in the reference of this especially. It was the earnest effort from our great God to ask an honest question, seeing if He could guide them. I don't think He asked it in a perturbed way of wanting to see how far He could pitch them and how far out of the garden He could cast them. He was interested in a concerned and loving way. He wanted to know if He could work with this. And our God is always a loving God. And I think it's important, I know it's important for us to understand that when this question then is posed by the Creator, it helps us to understand that the approach and confrontation should be just like His. It should be done in love. We should do any confrontation the same way that the Creator would do as He talked to Adam and Eve. And so again, wash the thought out of your minds that this is some hard, formidable enemy to mankind. No, this is the God that just created man and woman that we addressed in the sermonette and gave them to mankind, gave them as the opportunity to grow mankind and develop all that we are. He asked them something that He hoped would help guide them. And so we begin to learn some lessons about confrontation that are mentioned here by example. I don't think you sometimes see them unless you pick them out a little bit and look at them a little differently, approach them from a different angle. But that is indeed what happened. And then, as we know, the story goes on. They had to leave the garden. Angels with swords were put at the gates or the entrance so they couldn't come in and out. And they were banished from it. And they had to go outside and farm and live in a different environment than a sustained garden. The garden itself, Eden, when you look at the way that it is developed in the Scripture, and when you look at the formation of the tabernacle, the tent that the Israelites worshipped in the deserts, and when you look at the temple, all three of these and other structures as well have the same basic design. The gate or the entrance is always on the same side. They're always protected and walled on all sides. And so there are boundaries around the temple. There's boundaries around the tabernacle, and there were boundaries around Eden. And this is important for us to know because part of the whole confrontation issue has to do with boundaries. Time after time, it has to do with boundaries. Our boundaries in life must be firm. Our society today doesn't know much about boundaries. They have little thought about boundaries in life, let alone in activities that they engage in. You have boundaries in your own home. I think most of you have walls. Most of you have doors, don't you? Ceilings. You protect yourself. And in your backyard, if it's in the city, it probably has a gate around one side, walls, fences. It might be as simple as railroad ties showing where the line between properties is, but you have borders, boundaries. Not always in life are those boundaries established as closely as they should be. We're to indeed have a number of boundaries in our homes. You wives have set boundaries of where you want the kids to eat, and it's not in the living room. You can't eat in my living room. So we have our homes, and for the most part, I would think you have a boundary and you wouldn't have smoking allowed in your home. That's a principle that you have there. eating and drinking. We have grooming boundaries. We decide on hair and how indeed it should be groomed. We talk about our style and conservative dress. There are limits on most everything that we do. We limit ourselves on what we read and what we watch. We set boundaries. And when Adam and Eve are moved out of the garden, boundaries are something that they don't have. So I want you to remember in this first example of Adam and Eve that there is an open, honest, loving question posed, and there are also boundaries that need to be followed. There was a boundary around a tree, but they chose to break that boundary and take of the fruit. In Genesis 4, the first 16 verses, about half the chapter, is another example, biblical example, about this topic of confrontation. Here we have Adam and Eve, and the two children are born, and Abel keeps sheep, Cain is a tiller of the ground. In verse 3, and around the right time, they made an offering to the Lord. 4, and Abel brought of the fruit firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof, and the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering, but to Cain he had no respect. And Cain was very wroth, or very mad. It upset him. His countenance fell. He looked disgusted. And the Lord said, "Why are you disgusted, Cain? If you do well, shall not you be accepted? And if you do it right, it'll be okay. And if you don't, well, you know something's wrong. So why don't you turn around and do it right?" But Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass that when they were in the field, Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. And the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" He says, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" He says, "Well, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries to me from the ground. Now you're going to be cursed because of that. And when you till the earth, you're going to have yourself a hard time, and you're going to become a fugitive and a vagabond," it says in 12. And that's how you're going to live in the earth. Cain thought this was more than he could bear, so in 14, this is given. "I'm going to drive you out from me this day from the face of the earth, and from the face shall I be hid. I'll be a fugitive, a vagabond, and it shall come to pass that everyone that finds me, somebody's going to try to kill me." So the Lord said, "Therefore, whoever slays Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And he set a mark on him so they'd know which one he was. And he went out as a vagabond, wanderer. Again, the subject of having a relationship with your environment is mentioned. And the boundaries that Cain wished for are now gone. And he has no boundaries. In fact, he's sent to an area where there is no boundary. Very similar to what the problems were for Adam and Eve. Another thing that's mentioned here is that he didn't wish to take ownership for killing his brother. He didn't want to say, "Well, I did do that." No, he denied it, and he again played somewhat the blame game. It's important when we look at the topic of confrontation and we discuss some difficulty with a person, that we take ownership, that we don't say, "Well, this is what somebody said." No, it has to be something that you're personally involved with. And I think in that context, you'd remember Matthew 18, that when you have something against your brother, go to him personally. Take the matters personal. Don't take somebody else's sayings about what happened and try to resolve that conflict. Let them take care of that. Eventually, we find that many of the things we may try to solve will be only gossip and never really get around to taking it to our brother. So we see something common in these first couple examples: ownership and boundaries. Now, the Tower of Babel is my next example for you to consider in Genesis 11, the first 9 verses. Building this tower was a vivid demonstration of the power of unity. They are all of one language, one speech, and they journeyed from the east. They found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they stayed there, and they decided, let's make bricks, burn them, and we'll find ourselves making a city and a tower. We want the top of it to reach to heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Well, the Lord came down, and he saw the city and the tower which the men were building, and he says, the people is one. They have all one language. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. So let's confound their language that they may not understand one another's speech. And this then eventually scattered them abroad from there upon the face of the earth, and they left off to build that city. And then in 9, therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from there did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of the whole earth. When they were building this tower, and God saw it, it would appear that the purpose of it was contradictory and contrary to the will and purpose of God. And so their effective collaboration was interrupted by confusion of language. What was once very unifying no longer was possible, and there was conflict. And so when they would confront one another, there was no way to resolve the matters. They could not understand each other. And this shows another important part about the whole subject of confrontation. And that's communication. If you cannot communicate, you cannot build anything. It requires us putting some thought into communication. You can't build a project. You can't build a marriage. You can't build a business. You can't even build up a congregation if there isn't communication. If you cannot communicate, you will fail at one of the foundational needs of all mankind. One of the foundational needs of all human endeavors is to communicate. And if you can't, then you cannot solve any of your conflicts. And how to then discover how to do this communication is a very important matter. The Tower of Babel shows us that if we have all the same and likely communication, if we're one-on-one and agree on everything, who knows what success we could have. But when we don't communicate, we can't build anything. Ephesians 4:3 says, make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. If you've got the bond of peace, and that is part of the communication that you have developed, you could have unity. But if you won't have the bond of peace, if there's animosity, if there's a rub, if there's disagreement, if there's two different ways of doing things, you'll not have peace. Romans 12:18, I read to you, as much as possible, live peaceably with all men. And going back to one of my humorous beginnings with you, for me to have peace in my house, I've decided I got to love chicken. Now, I'm picky. I want the thigh or the leg. And I'm glad because She likes the wings, so we've got harmony. We communicate. We put a half a chicken on the grill, cook it, I get one half, she gets the other half. Everybody's happy. But you have to communicate. I don't know what we'd do if chickens had all legs and thighs. Reminds me, one time we had in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, we'd have these themed potlucks in this congregation. And my kids, at that point, they knew they liked chicken legs because that's what they always got, you know. And so we had foods of the kingdom. So Joy and I put our heads together and we brought a 12-legged chicken because that's what they're going to have in the kingdom to keep our kids happy. And Genesis 13 is the third example I have for you, Abraham and Lot. Genesis 13. In verse 5, these men both have a tremendous amount of livestock. They both had flocks, herds, and tents. And the land was not able to bear them, and that they might dwell together, for their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. And there was then strife between the herdsmen of the two camps. And the Canaanites and the Perizzites dwelled there in the land. So Abraham said to Lot, "Let's not have strife. Let's be happy between you and me, between our herdsmen. The whole land is out here. Why can't we just take care of this? So you go your way, and I'll go mine. If you go to the left, take all that land, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, then I'll go to the left. You decide." So Lot lifted his eyes and said, "I want to go to the plain of Jordan. It's well watered." This is where Sodom and Gomorrah were. So Lot chose all the plain of Jordan, and Lot went east to that, and they separated from each other. Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. The men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. Now there's one way that the conflict was settled. Confrontation was settled by Abraham deferring, saying that it's not worth the fight. And there was something that he knew. He had promises from God, a blessing he knew was going to be an outstanding blessing. So Abraham chose not to confront Lot. There's times when we might defer and don't confront. So Lot was taking whatever he wanted, and whatever Lot didn't want, Abraham then went in that direction. So in these four examples, we see some common thread about the importance of having boundaries, communication. These are important to the confrontation discussion. There's a thought about trying to do it God's way, having a loving way of talking to each other, and taking ownership. Now, to the second point, then, I want to talk about some behavior models in the subject of confrontation. You could break it down further or other ways, but I've broken down to four ways to deal with confrontation. And this somewhat depends on our personal background, how we've grown up, and what the needs might be at the time. But when we're thinking of these four types of confrontation, it's important that you think of motive. What is motivating you through the confrontation? Is it selfish, or are you trying to seek the will of God? Is God and God's purpose for you first, or is what's first in your mind yourself? The first example of this behavior style is that of a dictator. Dictator says, "I'm going to do it my way." Sometimes they assume the yelling solution, getting louder and louder. When they confront problems, they do it with the strength of the vocal cords, raising their blood pressure, slamming their fist, and that's the way it's going to be. the dictator. Frank Sinatra saying, "I did it my way." Well, it's a lilting song. Some that do it their own way, there's anything but lilt in the voice. See, dictators don't generally motivate. They intimidate because they're doing it selfishly. In Mark 11, verses 15 through 17, Mark 11, 15 through 17, we have Christ cleaning the money changers out of the temple. They came to Jerusalem, and Jesus went into the temple and began to cast out those that sold and bought in the temple, and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves. And he would not allow any man to carry any vessel through the temple. And he taught, saying, "It is written, my house shall be called of all nations a house of prayer," shouldn't it? "But you've made it a den of thieves." So his motive was changed from doing something selfishly. He was doing something that was God-centered. That was his motive, and he did it in a dictatorial fashion. He took absolute control, and they didn't know what to do about that. In fact, they were intimidated. And the dictator will intimidate, but what is the motive? Is it for the sake of the self, or for the sake and sanctity of the ways of God? When Christ cleaned out these money changers, he was an example of a dictator. Now, there are so many other examples that you can come across from your own reading of history in today's activities, even in politics, there's some understanding of what a dictator is. Some things a dictator decides not to allow. He won't allow some things at home, some things at work, so forth. There are some things that I, as a pastor, wouldn't allow in this congregation. Just inappropriate. We will not do certain things. We have principles that we live by in our congregation. We consider ourselves under the tutelage of God. We open with prayer and we close with prayer. So in this building, we're able to set up our boundaries, and we will not compromise our moral values or the values of our congregation. We have an environment in the services we want to keep proper, just as Christ was keeping a proper environment in the temple. And from time to time, people may come and bring their wares and their materials, but that isn't what we do here. And so we all have to stand together, shoulder to shoulder, making sure that anyone that would understand, this is, as it were, our congregation. Not that it is a temple, but we treat it with the same sanctity, with preference to God. We don't do that out of selfishness. We do it because it's the right thing to do before God. So we always have to stand shoulder to shoulder on some of these issues. And there are times then when we have to take the lead and express godly direction and godly boundaries. And when something is amiss, someone comes in and tries to sell you something or other or peddle their literature and so forth, that's not what we do here. People can read all the literature they want. They can buy anything they want, but we don't do that here. That isn't what we do here. So if you have an opportunity and something like that comes up, you can be a dictator. You can establish what is right and maintain that kind of leadership. So there's a way to deal with confrontation as a dictator. A second one is that I have for you is an accommodator. Accommodator, two C's, two M's. It's like Burger King. You can have it your way. You can get your hamburger with anything you want. We'll fix it for you. We'll accommodate you. The first time I went into a Burger King and I didn't even know what they were, They didn't have them in England where I went to school. I was with my brother-in-law. He's now deceased. But Glenn, Pat Glenn. And we went in there, and he ordered a triple patty. I said, what is that? And he showed me this hamburger that he could get himself around. Pat was a big guy. He was big, and he had just come to Ambassador kind of on a lark. He didn't know a whole lot about it, but it sounded like a good place to go. It was in California, and he is from New York City. And he's a very likable person. Pat was the heavyweight weightlifting champion for New York City when he was a senior in high school. I don't know what he could bench, but it was plenty. And when he was a freshman, his room monitor, a squeaky little guy, was trying to confront him over some issue. And Pat would not be confronted. So Pat whipped him off his feet, hung him by his two ankles in one hand, and put him out there over the stairwell, two stories down. And Pat got his way. He intimidated. It was all selfish. But he was accommodated. And sometimes we have to remember that people who are accommodating, all of a sudden their limits, their boundaries disappear. I'll do anything for you. And sometimes there's the fact that they suffer then silently. They adapt, they adjust, they placate. They'll do anything to avoid confrontation. They'll do anything to maintain a relationship. In the workplace, you sometimes find people that will accommodate to the individual that they favor. And when they do that, those that they don't favor are left on the outside. This happened to our daughter Chelsea recently, last year, at the IHOP where she worked in Flagstaff. She was a superior server and did her job beautifully, was well-liked. People came to her and would come back time after time to be served by her. But they decided to accommodate some particular group of people that were working there at the IHOP, and they did it to accommodate these others in such a way so they could receive advancement and kind of wall off Chelsea so she had less and less hours so these other girls could have the opportunities. So they created rules that made life miserable for one or two while appeasing others. That's what an accommodator will do. They'll do things for selfish reasons. But when you read the story of Abraham and Lot, you can see you can also accommodate for godly reasons. There's accommodation by Abraham. He valued his relationship more than property, wealth, or stuff. His motive was to fulfill the will of God. And that is so often with all of these subjects, whether it's dictator, accommodator, and the other two that I'll go through. Because it takes two people, you can have one wrong attitude and one right attitude and not make any headway at all because the motives are different. One motive might be very selfish. The other motive might be very God-centered. Or if they're both selfish, you'll never for sure get any headway. So these types of confrontation need to be understood. When you're looking at the issues that need resolving, whether in the workplace, in the family life, to be God-centered is so important. And you can't make it the fact that somebody else has to be God-centered. It has to be something that you're doing that's God-centered. To stop being an accommodator, to make sure your motives is always godly, there's one thing that you need to do. And this is, you could put a little phrase down in your notes if you're that note-taker type. See everyone on the same plane and express to them the same boundaries. See everyone on the same plane. Don't see a pecking order. Some are better than others. Or see everybody on the same plane. So we move from the accommodator to the third one, and the abdicator. Abdicator. I'll run away. They retreat. They resign. They surrender. They drop out. They don't come to work tomorrow. They just abdicate. They give in some instruction, and they can't follow it, won't follow it. They aren't even coming in. Sometimes people do that, and they don't find themselves happy at all. And they'll go in their corner, and they'll pout because they aren't getting their way. And so they just throw up their hands and abdicate. In the story of the prodigal son, that spendthrift son returned home. In Luke 15, verses 28 through 32, the other brother comes on the scene after we have the returning prodigal boy who spent his monies. And his brother says something here now in verse 28. He was angry. He would not go in. So his father came outside and asked him, "Why aren't you going to come in?" And he said to his father, "Lo, these many years I've served you. I haven't transgressed. I've never done anything wrong. I've always kept your commandments. But you never gave me a kid that I may make merry with my friends. But as soon as this brother of mine comes home, who's devoured all of his living, spent his inheritance, he's lived with harlots, you go ahead and kill for him the fatted calf." And so the father said, "Son, you're always with me, and all that I have is yours. It was proper that we should make merry and be glad. For your brother was dead, he's alive again, he was lost and is found." It's the right thing to do. In this story, the prodigal son gets the party, but his brother goes off and pouts. Sometimes we get real absorbed in our own little world and have that woe, woe, woe is me, because self is right there before us and we don't see anything else but self. When there needs to be some confrontation, all we can see is that I'm hurting. And so we go sit on our pity pot and expect everybody else to take care of us, when we're just going to sit there and we're not going to do nothing. We're not going to apologize. We're not going to be happy. We're not going to try to be sweet and amicable. In like parallel, there's in Genesis 16, the first six verses, Hagar, who has child by Abram. Genesis 16, the first six verses. Sarai, Abram's wife, didn't have children, but she had an Egyptian handmaid named Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Well, the Lord restrained me from birthing, so I ask you, go into my maid that I may obtain children by her, by proxy." So he listened to Sarai, and Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, by the hand into Abram, and she had 10 years in the land, they knew her well, and gave her to her husband, and Abram to be his wife. And he went in, and Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress, Sarai, was despised in her eyes. And so Sarai says unto Abram, "My wrong be upon you. I have given my maid to your bosom, and when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. And so here I am, not respected." But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your maid is in your hand. Do with her as you want." And when Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. So she was mean to her. And Hagar then leaves. And as you know the story, she's out there with her young son in the desert, finally finds sustenance. Hagar was kicked out when she was down and basically gave up as well. When you look at the subject of the abdicator, you can see that it is humility that is lacking. Humility is not their friends. And when you are an abdicator, it's very important that you have humility and that you admit your self-centered view, like the one of the person you should be. Admit that you're self-centered, like that obedient son, like Hagar. Sometimes we might want to even need to retreat to get our motive proper, to consider, well, what is my motive? You might need some space, some time to straighten out your mind. But realize that at the end, you must get off your pity pot. There are tangible and intangible assets. Both have value. And most people that are abdicators only look at the tangible assets. They don't look at their intangible assets. They look at stuff. They don't look at their future. They don't look at their mind. They don't look at the Christ that they're trying to become. Tangible assets gets a lot of people off the track. And in fact, if you go back through it, you'll find that that is part of what the dictator and the accommodator have in common. Tangible assets. This is so important. Stuff. So we then come to the fourth example of a way to deal with confrontation. We had the dictator, the accommodator, the abdicator, the collaborator is the fourth one, the collaborator. The collaborator says, let's find a way. And the person that he is confronting is saying, yeah, let's find a way. Let's solve this. They care about their relationships. They have maturity. They're emotionally balanced. They're God-centered. And they'll find a resolution to their confrontation. I found in the daughters of Zelophehad this example. In Numbers 27, the daughters of Zelophehad are mentioned. He had five girls, no sons. And we find in this story, 27, the family heritage is mentioned in verse 1, and then the five daughters are mentioned at the end of the verse. And these five girls stood before Moses and before Eleazar the priest, before the princes and all the congregation. They were there by the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And this is what they have to say. Dear Father Moses, our father died in the wilderness. He was not in the company of them that gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but he did die of his own sin, and he had no sons. So why should the name of our father be done away from among his family because he had no son? He wasn't a vile person like those that followed Korah, but he had problems. But he had no sons. And the way God has set this up, inheritance goes from father to son to grandson. That's how this is all set up. And here we are, five daughters. So I ask you, would you give us possession among the brethren of our father? Could we have some inheritance? Doesn't seem right. And in their way, they were collaborating and trying to find a resolution. So Moses brought their case before the Lord, and God said, well, they got a case. They speak right, he says in 7. So surely you should give them a possession of inheritance among the father's brethren. and you shall cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them. And you shall speak to the children of Israel, and saying, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall cause his inheritance to pass unto his daughter. And if he has no daughter, give that inheritance to the brothers, or his brother, his family. If he has no family, then give it to his father's family. So they changed the way, or God changed the way, in which inheritance was going to be passed around. And so this is what they did. It was a win-win situation. They found an inheritance, and all of their people then would be able to enjoy some place to call home. But then another item comes up in chapter 36 with these girls. God's made his statement about, go ahead and give the inheritance to daughters if there are no sons. And so others in the tribes of Israel say, well, wait a minute. If they go marry somebody else of one of the other tribes, and then they have no sons, then it passes back to the other tribes that these girls are from. And so we're kind of stuck. We start losing part of our real estate. So it says, and they said, the Lord commanded my Lord to give the land for an inheritance by lot to the children of Israel. And my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters. Now if they're married to any of the sons of other tribes, then shall their inheritance be taken from the inheritance of our fathers and be put to the inheritance of the tribe with whereunto they are received. So and the result is it's taken from the lot of our inheritance and it goes somewhere else. So that when the Jubilee year of release comes, then their inheritance will be put to the inheritance of the tribe where it was received. So shall their inheritance be taken away from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers. And so it's going to go down into another tribe, and we're going to start losing real estate. And so these words are said, and the word of the Lord said, well, these men of Joseph, they're saying something proper. So this is the thing which the Lord does command the daughters of Zelophehad. Let them marry to whom they think best. Only to the family of the tribe of their father shall they marry. They've got to marry within their tribe. And that's important. And we try to do that in our relationships here in the congregation. Try to marry people of likeness. So shall not the inheritance of the children of Israel remove from tribe to tribe. For every one of the children of Israel shall keep himself to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. And so on it goes. And so this is what they did. And things that then reorganized even a little further. But it was a win-win situation. The girls got some inheritance, had some land that they could look forward to. And on the other hand, it was fair then to the other tribes of Israel too. Now, this resolution, I don't know how long it took, but there's 9 interceding chapters. And I think that's an important little thought. Sometimes confrontation and resolution takes a little time. It takes time. In conclusion, I want to give you 6 keys to effective confrontation. Effective one-on-one, head-to-head, face-to-face resolution of problems. These are basically in the structure of statements. The first one, know the definition of confrontation. Don't be saddled with what you see people doing in the world, and they call that confrontation as 2 people just smacking each other in the face and not getting anywhere. Sometimes words get a bad rap, so it is with confrontation. It does have a positive definition. 2 people getting together and communicating sensibly for the will of God to be worked out, not for selfish personal reasons. Second key, have the right purpose. We know the scripture that unless the Lord builds a house, something's going to fall. They'll worry and it'll be useless at the end. So have the right person, purpose. Speaking truth in love and checking your motives, make sure you're honoring God, not yourself. Point three, realize there's a right time and place for this confrontation. The preparation will be more important than the time it takes to have the discussion. Have the right time and place. I've been putting thoughts together, had a little notebook with this and that in it. I've been working on this sermon for 2 months, and I've just scratched the surface. Of late, I was adding it up this morning. I've put about 20 hours into this so far. And it's not finished. I need to rewrite it. Don't have enough laughs in it. Maybe that's because it's so serious. But it takes time to do it right. You take time with things, massage them. Pray about them. Point four, own the problem that requires confrontation. It's your problem. It's not what you heard somebody else say. I heard that you're going out on Friday nights to parties. Is that true? I want to talk to you about that. Well, if you're going to play the third person, it's a rumor. If you play the first person, that means you were there and you saw him too. So you got to be careful with that. You got to live to a code. You got to live within your boundaries. You can't have confrontation over some rumor or someone else's problem. It has to be your confrontation over your issue. And after you look at it that way, then that's maybe when you decide, maybe I'll just let this slide because it's just not that important. Five. Realize you cannot change another person. And for all the confrontation and discussion and prayer and right time and right place, trying to put all that you can together, you might not resolve anything. And there's times when you just have to walk away and say, I did my best. We don't do all things perfectly and we can't solve all problems. There are times when confrontation will not bear any result. An example from my past might help. About 35 years ago, I was pastoring, and I had a member in the congregation who was older than I was by some, and so I don't feel bad in bringing up the example, because I think by now he would be dead. And I'm not going to tell you where it was and all that, but anyhow, he was a salesman. And as he sat at his desk waiting for people to come in the door, he had too much time. And so he decided that he would use his time in a biblical way, and he started drawing up a prophecy chart. And he asked me to come by someday and look at his prophecy chart. Well, I was expecting something like, you know, on a sheet of paper. Well, he had this great big old desk, and he was so glad to see me, and he reached back over here and pulled out a tube and unscrolled a manuscript that dripped off both sides of that desk, his prophecy chart. And he'd put tons of time into it, but it was wrong. So I tried to explain this to him. But, you know, you don't have some of your history here. And he would not hear of it at all. This was godly revealed. He knew he was right. And I was wrong. I wasn't anything I could do to change his mind. Sometimes you can't change another person's mind. And you just get on with your life. Sometimes the milk is spilt. Once it's spilt, it's not good. You just use a rag, wipe it up, and go on down the road. And the fourth, or sixth point, sorry. Listen. That's a very short point. Listen. By listening, we create an environment for validation. If you really listen, you can give self-worth to the party who is hearing you. If you ask them, now this is what you said, and repeat it back to them, this is what you're thinking that we should do, and so forth. And you build that relationship just by listening and then going back over the information with your party. Show that you're genuinely engaged. See, listening requires effort, and you then begin to sort out what you hear and also the things that you're not hearing. And it is in all of that that you might realize, oh, I didn't know that. That puts a whole new idea at why I was thinking we needed to resolve this conflict, have this confrontation discussion. I had no idea that you had six toes. And I was worried about the oversized shoes, and I thought you really needed help with your finances. I didn't know you had six toes. Hope I haven't trolled on any feet here, but it just comes to mind. But we need to listen. All in all, confrontation can be somewhat unsettling. We live in a day and age where resolving problems isn't the first thing we may think of. We just want everyone to do it our way. Well, know your boundaries. Know the boundaries of God. Try to live your godly life in a principled, godly way. And this will minimize any needs for confrontation. And when people come forward that there is something of confrontation, weigh it closely. It may not be that important. It might be real important. But it always takes time. So listen.